Dikem had to, 1, be alert to the dynamic between the excited, hopeful young woman and her worried parents, 2, notice the father's comment about the wine, 3, connect it to an idea, 4, be empowered to spend the restaurant's money on a gesture, and 5, deliver that gesture with grace. At any point, the chain could have been broken, and no one would have noticed. But the chain wasn't broken, and so it created the signature upwelling of warm emotion that has carried Meyer's ventures to success. The question is, how does Meyer accomplish this so reliably at so many restaurants? When you sit down across the table from Danny Meyer, his eyes lock on you in a mix of interest and empathy. His body language is relaxed and alert, but unhurried. His voice is steady, with a Midwestern earnestness that's vaguely reminiscent of Jimmy Stewart. If you ask him a question, say, "What's the best hamburger in New York?" he pauses before answering. He has devoted hundreds of hours to exploring this question, so he knows a great deal. But when he answers, that answer has nothing to do with his knowledge and everything to do with you. "Well," he says, "what kind of hamburger you like depends on what kind of mood you're in." We're in Maialino, one of his restaurants near Gramercy Park, and it's breakfast. Around us, the Meyerian universe is spinning contentedly. Fresh flowers burst from ceramic vases, and happy diners chat with attentive waiters. We're talking about how Meyer studied political science at Trinity College, and how he worked for a presidential campaign, which helped him see every worker as basically a volunteer, when, behind me, a tray accidentally slips from a waiter's hand and several water glasses smash on the floor. For a microsecond, all the action stops. Meyer raises a finger, pressing pause on our conversation so he can watch what happens. The waiter who dropped the glasses starts picking up the pieces, and another waiter arrives with a broom and a dustpan. The cleanup happens swiftly, and everyone turns back to their food. Then I ask Meyer why he was watching so closely. "I'm watching for what happens right afterward, and I'm looking for their energy level to go up," he says. "They connect to clean up the problem, and the energy level goes either up or down, and if we're doing our job right, their energy level will go up." He puts his fists together, and then makes an explosion gesture with his fingers. They are creating uplifting energy that has nothing to do with the task, and everything to do with each other and what comes next. It's not really that different from an ant colony or a beehive. Every action adds on to the others. I ask Meyer what a bad interaction looks like. "It's one of two things," he says. "Either they're disinterested, I'm just doing my job kind of thing, or they're angry at the other person or the situation. And if I were to see that, I would know that there's a deeper problem here, because the number one job is to take care of each other. I didn't always know that, but I know it now." Meyer starts telling me about his background, his youth in St. Louis, the early fascination with food and travel, the emotionally distant father who was in the hotel and food business, Meyer's last-second veer away from law school and into the restaurant business, and finally, the mid-1980s and the early days of Union Square Cafe, where his education really began. "I didn't know how to read a balance sheet," he says. "I didn't know how to manage flow or run a kitchen. I didn't know anything. But I did know how I wanted to make people feel. I wanted them to feel like they couldn't tell if they had stayed home or gone out." To do that, Meyer relied on instinct. He hired Midwesterners to increase friendliness. He trained the staff himself, play-acting various waiter-diner scenarios. When service was slow, as it often was in the early days, he placated guests with free wine and gave the staff latitude to provide treats. He made a habit of gathering tidbits of information to help his guests feel more at home. He paid particular attention to language. He hated waiter speak, like, "Are you still working on that? It's not work." Or, "Is everything to your liking?" So impersonal. Instead, he sought to create language that gave guests the feeling that the staff was on their side. For instance, when a reservation was unavailable, he would say, "Can you give me a range of times that work for you, so I can root for a cancellation?" Union Square Cafe was a huge success, with the ever-present Meyer working the door, bussing tables, and cleaning up spills. Then in 1995, he opened a second restaurant, Gramercy Tavern. And that's when things got difficult. Service started to slip. Food was inconsistent. Customers were unhappy. Meyer would split his time between the two restaurants, trying frantically to boost performance, but it wasn't working. "It was a complete nightmare," he says. "I was miserable. I was running back and forth between the two places, and neither of them was doing as well as I wanted. It was kind of a classic situation. I mean, this is why most people who open a restaurant open only one." It all came to a head one day that fall at Gramercy Tavern, when a regular customer who was hosting a lunch for six ordered salmon. She ate about half of it, then told the waiter that she didn't care for it. Could she have something else? The waiter brought a new dish, then asked Gramercy's manager whether the salmon should stay on the woman's bill. The manager said it should. After all, the woman had eaten more than half of the dish, and there had been nothing wrong with the salmon. When the woman paid, she was handed a doggy bag with the remains of her salmon. When the woman got home, she wrote to Meyer, "I can't believe how insulting and passive-aggressive this was, and it's not what I would expect at one of your restaurants." "She was absolutely right," Meyer says. "And here's the worst part. Everybody at Gramercy thought they were doing a good job. The manager thought they were doing a good job. The waiter thought they were doing a good job. Everybody stood there and watched this happen, and nobody stopped it. We had spent hours and hours training people not to do this kind of thing, but they were doing it, and we had no control. That's when I knew that I had to find a way to build a language, to teach behavior. I could no longer just model the behavior and trust that people would understand and do it. I had to start naming stuff." A few weeks later, Meyer invited the entire staff to a Saturday retreat along the Hudson River and started a conversation about values. What were they really about? What did they stand for? Who came first? "That salmon incident was the Plymouth Rock moment," said Richard Corain, chief development officer of the Union Square Hospitality Group, the parent company for Meyer's restaurants. Danny realized that he needed to be in two places at once, which meant that he had to find a way to deliver the signal. People will respond to what their boss feels is important, so Danny had to define and articulate what was important. At the retreat, Meyer and the staff ranked their priorities. 1. Colleagues. 2. Guests. 3. Community. 4. Suppliers. 5. Investors. For Meyer, this was a breakthrough. "Naming these things felt incredibly good," he says. "Getting all this out in the open. The manager who'd caused the salmon problem ended up leaving, and that's when things started to take off, and I realized that how we treat each other is everything. If we do that well, everything else will fall into place." In a similar way, Meyer then attempted to name the specific behaviors and interactions he wanted to create at his restaurants. He already had an assortment of catchphrases that he used informally in training. He had a knack for distilling ideas into handy maxims. But now he started paying deeper attention to these phrases, thinking about them as tools. Here are a few. Read the guest. Athletic hospitality. Writing a great final chapter. Turning up the home dial. Loving problems. Finding the yes. Collecting the dots and connecting the dots. Creating raves for guests. One size fits one. Skunking. Making the charitable assumption. Planting like seeds in like gardens. Put us out of business with your generosity. Be aware of your emotional wake. To get a hug, you have to give a hug. The excellence reflex. Are you an agent or a gatekeeper? On the surface, these look like garden-variety corporate aphorisms. In fact, each of them functions as a small narrative in itself, providing a vivid mental model for solving the routine problems the staff faced. Making the charitable assumption means that when someone behaves poorly, you should avoid judging them and instead give them the benefit of the doubt. Collecting the dots means gathering information about guests. Connecting the dots is using that information to create happiness. Skunking is spraying negative energy into the workplace, as skunks do when they're frightened. By themselves, these phrases are unremarkable. But together, endlessly repeated and modeled through behavior, they create a larger conceptual framework that connects with the group's identity and expresses its core purpose. We take care of people. Meyer became more intentional about embedding his catchphrases and stating priorities in training, staff meetings, and all communications. He pushed his leaders to seek opportunities to use and model the key behaviors. He began to treat his role as that of a culture broadcaster. And it worked. In a few months, the atmosphere at both restaurants improved markedly. Meyer kept it up, steadily expanding and refining the language. "You have priorities, whether you name them or not," he says. "If you want to grow, you'd better name them, and you'd better name the behaviors that support the priorities." A couple years after the salmon incident, an NYU doctoral student in organizational behavior named Susan Riley Salgado became curious about why Meyer's restaurants felt so different from all others. As she chatted with the waitstaff, she noticed that they all tended to describe their jobs with the same words: home, family, warmth. She approached Meyer and asked him if she could make the restaurant the subject of her research, and he agreed, provided she took a job there. Salgado worked at Union Square Cafe for 6 months. She watched the way the staff members interacted with one another and with customers, and she noticed what she called microprocesses that drove those interactions. Here is how she summed up her findings in her dissertation. "The results indicate that Union Square Cafe achieves its differentiation strategy of enlightened hospitality through a synergistic set of human resource management practices involving three key practices: selection of employees based on emotional capabilities, respectful treatment of employees, and management through a simple set of rules that stimulate complex and intricate behaviors benefiting customers." A simple set of rules that stimulate complex and intricate behaviors benefiting customers. Salgado discovered, in other words, that Meyer succeeded for the same reason James Burke succeeded with the Credo Challenge. Creating engagement around a clear, simple set of priorities can function as a lighthouse, orienting behavior and providing a path toward a goal. All of which raises the deeper question of how exactly this happens, how a handful of catchphrases and a list of priorities can produce such smooth and proficient performance. We can get an answer from an unlikely source, a tiny organism called a slime mold. Slime molds are ancient, blob-like organisms made up of thousands of individual amoebae. Most of the time, slime molds are passive, sedate, and wholly unremarkable. But when food becomes scarce, the thousands of amoebae begin to work together in a beautiful and intelligent way. Back in the 1940s, a Harvard undergraduate named John Tyler Bonner photographed slime molds with a time-lapse camera and made a film, which he began to show to academic audiences. Word spread, and before long, lecture halls were overflowing with enraptured crowds. Albert Einstein requested a private viewing. J.J. O'Neill of the New York Herald Tribune told Bonner that his work was more important than the discovery of the atomic bomb. The film's first frames show a disconnected scattering of small gray blobs. But then, as if responding to an invisible signal, the amoebae move with a single intent toward the center, where thousands of them fuse together into a single organism that starts to move. At the tip of the organism, another transformation happens as some of the amoebae crawl upward, forming a stalk. Other amoebae crawl over them, where they become spores to blow off in the wind and reproduce. The whole thing is utterly magical and orchestral, as if some hidden conductor were whispering instructions. You over here, now all together. The film became a sensation because it embodied a profound mystery. How does this kind of intelligent group behavior happen with creatures that possess no intelligence? For years, researchers presumed that the behavior was a result of an organizer's cell that functioned as a kind of biological drill sergeant, telling the others what to do and when. This organizer cell, it turns out, does not exist. What does exist is something more powerful, a simple set of rules called heuristics that drive behavior. We assume that because we are complex, that the way we make decisions is also complex, says Madeline Beekman, who studies slime molds at the University of Sydney. But in reality, we're using very simple rules of thumb. The slime mold shows us that it's possible for groups to solve extremely complex problems using a few rules of thumb. In the case of slime molds, these rules of thumb are as follows. If there's no food, connect with one another. If connected, stay connected and move toward the light. If you reach the light, stay connected and climb. Honeybees work the same way, Beekman says. So do ants and many other species. They all use decision-making heuristics. There's no reason we wouldn't use it too. If you look at these species, you can feel the connection. Like us, they all seek a collective goal. Beekman and the slime molds give us a new way to think about why Danny Meyer's catchphrases work so well. They are not merely catchphrases. They are heuristics that provide guidance by creating if-then scenarios in a vivid, memorable way. Structurally, there is no difference between if someone is rude, make a charitable assumption, and if there's no food, connect with one another. Both function as a conceptual beacon, creating situational awareness and providing clarity in times of potential confusion. This is why so many of Meyer's catchphrases focus on how to respond to mistakes. You can't prevent mistakes, but you can solve problems graciously. If it ain't broke, fix it. Mistakes are like waves. Servers are really surfers. The road to success is paved with mistakes well handled. The trick is not just to send the signal, but to create engagement around it. This is where Meyer excels. He approaches the catchphrase creating process with the focused verve of a pop songwriter. He generates constantly, testing which ones work. He seeks snappy, visceral phrases that use vivid images to help team members connect. Richard Corain's office contains a whiteboard that is covered with works in progress. We are all paid to solve problems. Make sure to pick fun people to solve problems with. There's glory in making a mistake. Stone after stone to form a bridge. Meyer's not alone. Many leaders of high proficiency groups focus on creating priorities, naming keystone behaviors, and flooding the environment with heuristics that link the two. For example, if you spend time around the New Zealand All Blacks rugby team, you will hear them talk about leaving the jersey in a better place and saying, if you're not growing anywhere, you're not going anywhere. Keeping a blue head instead of a red head, which refers to calmness under pressure. Pressure is a privilege. TQB, total quality ball. KBA, keep the ball alive. Front up or fuck off. It's an honor, not a job. Go for the gap. And better people make better All Blacks. KIP, the network of highly successful charter schools, is similarly built around catchphrases like No shortcuts. Work hard, be nice. Don't eat the marshmallow. Team and family. If there's a problem, we look for the solution. Read, baby, read. All of us will learn. Kipsters do the right thing when no one is watching. Everything is earned. Be the constant, not the variable. If a teammate needs help, we give. If we need help, we ask. No robots, and prove the doubters wrong. At first encounter, a heuristic-dense culture feels slightly off-putting. For the first few days I worked here, I heard all the language, and it was like, are we in summer camp? Says Allison Stodd, Shake Shack's senior marketing and communications manager. It's totally hokey and corny. And then you start to see how they work, and you start using them in regular life. Then all of a sudden, they're not corny, they're just part of the oxygen. The most powerful thing about all those phrases is the way Danny embodies them, says Corain. What he's exceptional at is realizing that people are looking at him every second, and he's delivering those messages every second, every day. He's like a powerful Wi-Fi signal. Some people send 3 bars, but Danny is at 10 bars, and he never goes below 9. 16. How to lead for creativity. On a fundamental level, Danny Meyer, Kip, and the All Blacks are using the same purpose-building technique. We might call it the lighthouse method. They create purpose by generating a clear beam of signals that link A, where we are, to B, where we want to be. There's another dimension of leadership, however, where the goal isn't to get from A to B, but to navigate to an unknown destination, X. This is the dimension of creativity and innovation. Creative leadership appears to be mysterious, because we tend to regard creativity as a gift, as a quasi-magical ability to see things that do not yet exist and to invent them. Accordingly, we tend to think of creative leaders as artists, able to tap into wellsprings of inspiration and genius that are inaccessible to the rest of us. And to be sure, some leaders fit this description. The funny thing is, when I visited leaders of successful creative cultures, I didn't meet many artists. Instead, I met a different type. A type who spoke quietly and tended to spend a lot of time observing, who had an introverted vibe and liked to talk about systems. I started to think of this type of person as a creative engineer. Ed Catmull is such a leader. A soft-spoken 72-year-old with a bristly beard and quick, watchful eyes, he is president and co-founder of Pixar, one of the most successful creative cultures of all time. Every other studio in the world hopes to create a hit once in a while. Pixar can be thought of as a machine that creates hits every single time. Since 1995, it has made 17 feature films, which have earned an average of more than $500 million, won 13 Academy Awards, and generated some of the most beloved cultural touchstones of our age. A decade ago, Catmull took a side job of co-leading Walt Disney Animation Studios and helped it generate a string of blockbusters, including Frozen, Big Hero 6, and Zootopia. I met Catmull at Pixar's headquarters in Emeryville, California, inside the studio's sleek Brooklyn building. Brooklyn, built in 2010, is a sunlit box of glass and reclaimed wood, brimming with Pixarian touches like a speakeasy, a fireplace, a full-service cafe, and a roof deck. It is easily one of the most stunning office buildings I've ever seen. As one early visitor put it, "Thanks for ruining the rest of my life." As Catmull and I walk through shafts of sunlight, I make a passing remark about the building's beauty. He stops and turns to face me. His voice is quiet and authoritative, the voice of a doctor making a diagnosis. "In fact, this building was a mistake." I lean in, unsure I've heard correctly. "The reason it's a mistake," Catmull continues evenly, "is that it doesn't create the kinds of interactions we need to create. We should have made the hallways wider We should have made the cafe bigger to draw more people. We should have put the offices around the edges to create more shared space in the center. So it wasn't like there was one mistake. There were really a lot of mistakes, along, of course, with the bigger mistake that we didn't see most of the mistakes until it was too late. This is an unusual thing for a president of a company to say. If you compliment most leaders on their beautiful multi-million dollar building, they say thank you, and they mean it. Most leaders will not admit mistakes of this magnitude because they feel the admission would produce a dangerous whiff of incompetence. But not Catmull. He loves these moments. In a way, he lives for them. There is no blame or judgment in his gaze, only a quiet satisfaction born of clarity. We made some mistakes with this building, and now we know that, and we are slightly better because we know that. If you set out to design a life that represented the perfect merger of art and science, you might design one that looks like Catmull's. The child of educators, he spent his early years idolizing Einstein and Disney, studying drawing and physics, and dreaming of making feature-length animated movies. After college, he landed a job with George Lucas, which led to a partnership with Steve Jobs and the creation of Pixar, a small studio with ambitions of fusing computers and filmmaking. For several years, Pixar struggled. Then in 1995 came the breakthrough, the $360 million success of Toy Story. That's when Catmull began to get a nagging feeling that something was out of balance. He knew that other companies had been in this precise situation, on top of the world, flush with cash, lauded for their creativity and innovation. And most of them had stumbled, lost their way, and collapsed. The question was why? And how could Pixar avoid that fate? Catmull talked about that moment in a podcast. So the question was, okay, how do you make it so that it's sustainable? Because the people I knew of who were in these failed companies, and I had a lot of friends in Silicon Valley, were smart, and they were creative, and they were hard-working. So whatever problem was actually leading them astray was really hard to see, and the implication was, whatever that force was, it would also apply to us at Pixar. So this became the interesting question. These forces are at work. Can we find them before they do us in? So at the end of the year, I realized that this is actually the next goal. It's not a film. It's how we can have an environment where we can find and address these problems. We leave the Brooklyn building and walk across campus to the Steve Jobs building, which possesses many of the features Brooklyn lacks. A massive and welcoming central atrium, wide hallways for congregation, and a hive-like buzz. Near the stairs on the second floor stand two offices that embody the two pillars of Pixar's creative approach. The office on the left belongs to John Lasseter, Pixar's creative compass, master storyteller, and muse. His office is almost invisible beneath a day-glow moraine of toys, action figures, dolls, both old and new, dozens of versions of Mickey Mouse, Woody, and Buzz Lightyear. On the right is Catmull's office, looking as if it were lifted intact from a German aerospace firm. Cool, efficient rectangles, rendered in black, white, and gray. Catmull sits down and starts explaining, in his calm, doctorly voice, how Pixar's creativity happens. "All the movies are bad at first," he says. "Some are beyond bad. Frozen and Big Hero 6, for instance, were unmitigated disasters. The stories were flat, the characters weren't there. They sucked. I'm not saying that in a modest way. I was in the meetings. I saw the early versions, and they were bad. Really bad." This pattern is not unusual at Pixar. In the original Toy Story, Woody started out as bossy and unlikable. "A sarcastic jerk," Catmull says. The early versions of Up were so bad that the entire story was changed. "Literally the only thing that stayed the same was the word Up," he says. When most people tell stories about their successful creative endeavors, those stories often go like this. The project started out as a complete disaster, but then at the last moment, somehow we managed to rescue it. This arc is attractive because it dramatizes the improbability of the rescue, and thus places the teller in a flattering light. But Catmull is doing something profoundly different. He sees the disaster and the rescue not as improbable companions, but as causally related. The fact that these projects start out as painful, frustrating disasters is not an accident, but a necessity. This is because all creative projects are cognitive puzzles involving thousands of choices and thousands of potential ideas, and you almost never get the right answer right away. Building purpose in a creative group is not about generating a brilliant moment of breakthrough, but rather about building systems that can churn through lots of ideas in order to help unearth the right choices. This is why Catmull has learned to focus less on the ideas than on people, specifically on providing teams with tools and support to locate paths, make hard choices, and navigate the arduous process together. There's a tendency in our business, as in all businesses, to value the idea as opposed to the person or a team of people, he says. But that's not accurate. Give a good idea to a mediocre team, and they'll find a way to screw it up. Give a mediocre idea to a good team, and they'll find a way to make it better. The goal needs to be to get the team right, get them moving in the right direction, and get them to see where they are making mistakes and where they are succeeding. I ask Catmull how he knows when a team is succeeding. Mostly you can feel it in the room, he says. When a team isn't working, you see defensive body language, or you see people close down. Or there's just silence. The ideas stop coming, or they can't see the problems. We used to use Steve Jobs as a kind of 2x4 to whack people in the head so they could see the problems in the movie. Steve was good at that. But it becomes harder and harder as time goes on, because as directors get more experience, they sometimes have a harder time hearing other points of view that might help them. There are so many parts you have to get right, and it's so easy to get lost in this swirling mass. Your first conclusions are always wrong, and so are your second and your third. So you have to create mechanisms where teams of people can keep working together to see what's really happening, and then work together to solve the problems. Pixar realizes these mechanisms in a set of regular organizational habits. In the dailies, held in the morning, all of Pixar's people gather to view and comment on the previous day's footage. Animation is a spectacularly slow process. Each day produces only a few seconds of film. In field trips, teams immerse themselves in the environments of their movies. Scuba diving trips for the Finding Nemo team, archery lessons for the Brave team, cooking lessons for the Ratatouille team. In brain trust meetings, discussed in Chapter 7, a team of Pixar's top storytellers provides regular, vigorously candid, and painful feedback on films in development. At Pixar University, an assortment of classes acts as a kind of mixer, allowing people from different areas of the company to learn side by side. The classes teach everything from fencing to painting to Tai Chi. And in the postmortems, off-site retreats that Catmull organizes after a film is completed, the team members capture and share the biggest takeaways from the process. Each gathering brings team members together in a safe, flat, high-candor environment and lets them point out problems and generate ideas that move the team stepwise toward a better solution. Not surprisingly, Catmull is a passionate admirer of the Japanese concept of Kaizen, or continual improvement. Most of these meetings access the brain power of the entire group, while maintaining the creative team's ownership over the project. You see this pattern with many highly creative groups, such as Lockheed's famous Skunk Works, which designed the U-2, the Blackbird, the Nighthawk, and several other legendary planes in record time. Xerox's PARC, which invented the computer interface that Steve Jobs borrowed for Apple. Google X, Procter & Gamble's Clay Street, and Mattel's Project Platypus, all of which are essentially the same place, physically distant from the parent group, non-hierarchical, and given maximum autonomy. Accordingly, Catmull has almost no direct involvement with creative decisions. This is because he realizes that, one, the teams are in a better position to solve problems, and two, a suggestion from a powerful person tends to be followed. One of his frequently used phrases is, "Now it's up to you." This is also why he tends to let a troubled project roll on a bit too long, as he puts it, before pulling the plug and/or restarting it with a different team. "If you do a restart before everyone is completely ready, you risk upsetting things," he says. "You have to wait until it's clear to everyone that it needs to be restarted." Catmull is congenitally wary of mottos and catchphrases, as he believes they can easily distort reality. Nonetheless, a handful of Ed-isms are heard in Pixar's corridors. Here are a few. Hire people smarter than you. Fail early, fail often. Listen to everyone's ideas. Face toward the problems. B-level work is bad for your soul. It's more important to invest in good people than in good ideas. You'll notice that, in contrast to Danny Meyer's vivid, specific language, these are defiantly uncatchy, almost zen-like in their plainness and universality. This reflects the fundamental difference between leading for proficiency and leading for creativity. Meyer needs people to know and feel exactly what to do, while Catmull needs people to discover that for themselves. Catmull spends his days roving around Pixar and Disney, watching. He helps onboard new employees and observes brain trust meetings, hawkeyeing the interactions for signs of incipient trouble or success. He cultivates back-channel conversations to find out what's going on behind the scenes. He worries when he sees awkward silences or people avoiding each other. He celebrates when a group takes initiative without asking permission, such as when a group of animators organized an impromptu Boy Scout-themed sleepover on Pixar's lawn. He defends teams when they make mistakes, and they can make some extremely expensive mistakes. If Danny Meyer is a lighthouse, beaming signals of purpose, then Catmull is more like the engineer of a ship. Catmull doesn't steer the ship. He roves around below decks, checking the hull for leaks, changing out a piston, adding a little oil here and there. "For me, managing is a creative act," he says. "It's problem solving, and I love doing that." If you were to create a field experiment to test Catmull's leadership methods, it might consist of the following steps. 1. Locate a struggling movie studio. 2. Place Catmull in charge and, without changing any personnel, allow him to re-engineer the group's culture. Then you would wait to see what happened. That, in fact, is precisely what happened in 2006. The struggling studio happened to be Walt Disney Animation. After a run of success in the 1990s, Disney had entered a decade-long creative wasteland, producing a series of films that were consistently flat and dull and, not coincidentally, unprofitable. This string included The Lost Empire, Brother Bear, Treasure Planet, and Home on the Range, which featured a burping cow, voiced by Roseanne Barr. So Disney CEO Bob Iger attempted the corporate equivalent of a heart transplant, purchasing Pixar and putting Catmull and Lasseter in charge of reviving the most storied brand in animation, and maybe in all of entertainment. Most observers didn't expect the combination to work out. For starters, there was the size differential. Pixar was relatively small, while Disney was gargantuan, and it was hard to imagine that Catmull and Lasseter could control it. "Like Nemo swallowing the whale," was the way Fortune magazine put it. Another factor was the geographic challenge. Pixar was in Emeryville, near Oakland, while Disney was 350 miles away in Burbank. Entertainment industry history showed that these kinds of acquisitions were risky and often harmful to both parties, After the sale went through, Catmull and Lasseter traveled to Burbank and made a speech to Disney employees. Lasseter was inspiring, talking about legacy and rejuvenation. Catmull, typically, said about two sentences. "We're not going to turn Disney into a clone of Pixar. What we're going to do is build a studio on your talent and passion." They got to work, starting with physical structure. At the time of the acquisition, Disney employees were scattered across four floors of a giant building, siloed in groups that reflected their expertise, animation, layout, design, rather than their collaborative function. Catmull headed up a rebuild that smooshed all the creative and technical people together around a central gathering place called the Caffeine Patch. He then put his and Lasseter's offices, they committed to spending 2 days a week at Disney, near the center. Next, Catmull focused on creative structure. Disney had been using the conventional film development model, which worked as follows. 1. Studio executives create development teams, which are charged with generating stories. 2. Studio executives evaluate those ideas, decide which would be developed, and assign directors to each one. 3. Directors make the movies, and executives evaluate early versions, offer notes, and occasionally create competitions called bake-offs to decide which film is ready for release. Catmull flipped that system on its head, removing creative power from the executives and placing it in the hands of the directors. In the new structure, the directors were responsible for coming up with their own ideas and pitching them, rather than being assigned them by studio executives. The job of the executives was not to be all deciding bosses, but rather to support the directors and their teams as they undertook the painful journey from idea to workable concept to finished film. Early in the transition, Catmull invited Disney directors and executives to Pixar to observe a brain trust meeting. They watched the team work together to pick a movie apart and do the hard work of rebuilding it. The change in the energy at Disney was immediate. Disney directors called it a breath of fresh air and likened it to the fall of the Berlin Wall. It was a moment of hope, reinforced by the fact that the Disney team's subsequent movie improvement meetings, they dubbed them the Story Trust, were judged to be the best and most useful anyone there had experienced. Catmull, however, wasn't as quick to celebrate, knowing that real change wasn't going to happen overnight. "It takes time," he says. "You have to go through some failures and some screw-ups and survive them and support each other through them. And then after that happens, you really begin to trust one another." Which is what happened. The first few films after the acquisition were immediately better, scoring improved reviews as well as box office success. Then, in 2010, Disney's teams began clicking at a Pixarian level with Tangled, $591 million in worldwide box office, Wreck-It Ralph, $471 million, Frozen, $1.2 billion, Big Hero 6, $657 million, and Zootopia, $931 million. Catmull notes that the transformation happened with virtually no turnover. "The people who made these films are the same people who were there when they were failing," he says. "We put in some new systems, they learned new ways of interacting, and they changed their behavior. And now they are a completely different group of people when they work together." "We put in some new systems, and they learned new ways of interacting." It's strange to think that a wave of creativity and innovation can be unleashed by something as mundane as changing systems and learning new ways of interacting. But it's true, because building creative purpose isn't really about creativity. It's about building ownership, providing support, and aligning group energy toward the arduous, error-filled, ultimately fulfilling journey of making something new. 17. Ideas for action. Here's a surprising fact about successful cultures. Many were forged in moments of crisis. Pixar's crisis occurred in 1998, when it set out to make a straight-to-video sequel to the highly acclaimed Toy Story. The studio embarked on the project, presuming it would be a relatively simple process. After all, how hard could a sequel be? But early versions were awful. The story lacked emotion, the characters were flat, and the film lacked the sparkle and heart of the original. Catmull and Lasseter realized this was a question of Pixar's core purpose. Was it a studio that did average work, or one that aimed for greatness? At their urging, Pixar scrapped the early versions and started over at the 11th hour, aiming for a full theatrical release instead of video. This successful last-minute push crystallized Pixar's identity and resulted in the invention of many of its signature collaborative systems, including the Brain Trust. The SEALs experienced a similar moment in 1983, during the invasion of Grenada. The mission had been straightforward. One team would parachute into the sea, swim to shore, and capture Grenada's only radio antenna. Unfortunately, a combination of weather, poor communication, and bad decisions led to the team being dropped at night in a storm, overloaded with gear. The result was the drowning deaths of four SEALs, and a subsequent rebuilding of the group's decision-making and communications systems. Danny Meyer's early days as a restaurateur, too, were punctuated by a string of near disasters. "We nearly killed a customer when a light fixture fell out of a wall," he says. "Another time, I got into a fist fight with a customer who'd had too much to drink. And I'm not talking just a shoving match. It was a real fist fight in front of the whole restaurant. He punched me in the jaw and slammed my head in a door, and I kicked him in the nuts." Let's just say that we're lucky that the internet didn't exist in those days. The difference with successful cultures seems to be that they use the crisis to crystallize their purpose. When leaders of those groups reflect on those failures now, they express gratitude, and sometimes even nostalgic desire for those moments, as painful as they were, because they were the crucible that helped the group discover what it could be. This gives us insight into building purpose. It's not as simple as carving a mission statement in granite or encouraging everyone to recite from a hymnal of catchphrases. It's a never-ending process of trying, failing, reflecting, and above all, learning. High-purpose environments don't descend on groups from on high. They are dug out of the ground, over and over, as a group navigates its problems together and evolves to meet the challenges of a fast-changing world. Here are a few ideas to help you do that. Name and rank your priorities. In order to move toward a target, you must first have a target. Listing your priorities, which means wrestling with the choices that define your identity, is the first step. Most successful groups end up with a small handful of priorities, five or fewer. And many, not coincidentally, end up placing their in-group relationships, how they treat one another, at the top of the list. This reflects the truth that many successful groups realize. Their greatest project is building and sustaining the group itself. If they get their own relationships right, everything else will follow. Be 10 times as clear about your priorities as you think you should be. A while back, Inc. magazine asked executives at 600 companies to estimate the percentage of their workforce who could name the company's top 3 priorities. The executives predicted that 64% would be able to name them. When Inc. then asked employees to name the priorities, only 2% could do so. This is not the exception, but the rule. Leaders are inherently biased to presume that everyone in the group sees things as they do, when in fact they don't. This is why it's necessary to drastically over-communicate priorities. The leaders I visited with were not shy about this. Statements of priorities were painted on walls, stamped on emails, incanted in speeches, dropped into conversation, and repeated over and over until they became part of the oxygen. One way to create awareness is to make a habit of regularly testing the company's values and purpose, as James Burke did with the Credo Challenge. This involves creating conversations that encourage people to grapple with the big questions. What are we about? Where are we headed? Many of the leaders I met seemed to do this instinctively, cultivating what might be called a productive dissatisfaction. They were mildly suspicious of success. They presumed that there were other, better ways of doing things, and they were unafraid of change. They presumed they didn't have all the answers, and so constantly sought guidance and clarity. Figure out where your group aims for proficiency and where it aims for creativity. Every group skill can be sorted into one of two basic types: skills of proficiency and skills of creativity. Skills of proficiency are about doing a task the same way every single time. They are about delivering machine-like reliability, and they tend to apply in domains in which the goal behaviors are clearly defined, such as service. Building purpose to perform these skills is like building a vivid map. You want to spotlight the goal and provide crystal-clear directions to the checkpoints along the way. Ways to do that include: fill the group's windshield with clear, accessible models of excellence. Provide high repetition, high feedback training. Build vivid, memorable rules of thumb. If X, then Y. Spotlight and honor the fundamentals of the skill. Creative skills, on the other hand, are about empowering a group to do the hard work of building something that has never existed before. Generating purpose in these areas is like supplying an expedition. You need to provide support, fuel, and tools, and to serve as a protective presence that empowers the team doing the work. Some ways to do that include: keenly attend to team composition and dynamics. Define, reinforce, and relentlessly protect the team's creative autonomy. Make it safe to fail and to give feedback. Celebrate hugely when the group takes initiative. Most groups, of course, consist of a combination of these skill types, as they aim for proficiency in certain areas and creativity in others. The key is to clearly identify these areas and tailor leadership accordingly. Embrace the use of catchphrases. When you look at successful groups, a lot of their internal language features catchphrases that often sound obvious, rah-rah, or corny. Many of us instinctively dismiss them as cultish jargon. But this is a mistake. Their occasionally cheesy obviousness is not a bug, it's a feature. Their clarity, grating to the outsider's ear, is precisely what helps them function. The trick to building effective catchphrases is to keep them simple, action-oriented, and forthright. Create fun and a little weirdness. Zappos. Talk less, do more. IDEO. Work hard, be nice. KIP. Pound the rock. San Antonio Spurs. Leave the jersey in a better place. New Zealand All Blacks. Create raves for guests. Danny Meyer's Restaurants. They're hardly poetry, but they share an action-based clarity. They aren't gentle suggestions so much as clear reminders, crisp nudges in the direction the group wants to go. Measure what really matters. The main challenge to building a clear sense of purpose is that the world is cluttered with noise, distractions, and endless alternative purposes. One solution is to create simple, universal measures that place focus on what matters. A good example happened in the early days of Zappos, when Tony Hsieh noticed that call center workers were measured by the number of calls they handled per hour. He realized that this traditional measure was at odds with the group's purpose, and that it was driving unwanted behaviors, haste and brevity, for starters. So he banished that metric and replaced it with personal emotional connections, PECs, or creating a bond outside the conversation about the product. It's impossible, of course, to measure pecs precisely, but the goal here is not precision. It is to create awareness and alignment and to direct behavior toward the group's mission. So when a customer service agent spent a company record 10 hours and 29 minutes on a call, Zappos celebrated and sent out a press release. The call covered a wide variety of subjects, including movies, favorite foods, and what it's like to live in Las Vegas. It resulted in the sale of one pair of UGG boots. Use artifacts. If you traveled from Mars to Earth to visit successful cultures, it would not take you long to figure out what they were about. Their environments are richly embedded with artifacts that embody their purpose and identity. These artifacts vary widely. The battle gear of soldiers killed in combat at the Navy SEAL headquarters, the Oscar trophies accompanied by hand-drawn sketches of the original concepts at Pixar, and the rock and sledgehammer behind glass at the San Antonio Spurs practice facility, embodying the team's catchphrase, "Pound the Rock." But they all reinforce the same signal. This is what matters. Focus on bar-setting behaviors. One challenge of building purpose is to translate abstract ideas, values, mission, into concrete terms. One way successful groups do this is by spotlighting a single task and using it to define their identity and set the bar for their expectations. One good example is the men's hockey team at Quinnipiac University, a small school in Hamden, Connecticut. The team fields few highly recruited players, yet it has spent the last half decade as one of the nation's top-ranked teams. Quinnipiac's coach, Rand Pecknold, has built a culture around a specific behavior he calls 40 for 40. The phrase refers to back-checking, which means rushing back to the defensive end in response to the other team's attack, basically chasing them down. Back-checking happens around 40 times per game, and it is Pecknold's goal that his players go all out with 100% effort on each one. In other words, 40 for 40. It is not easy to do. Back-checking is exhausting, requires keen attentiveness, and, here's the key, rarely makes a difference in the game. "It almost never pays off," Pecknold says. "You can back-check 39 times in a row, and it doesn't make any difference at all in the play. But the 40th time, maybe something happens. You get a stick in, you steal the puck, you stop a goal, or you create a turnover that leads to a goal. That one back check doesn't show up anywhere in the stat books, but it can change a game. That's why we are 40 for 40. That's who we are." Quinnipiac team members talk about 40 for 40 all the time. They talk about it during practice, during games, and during Pecknold's regular one-on-one meetings with players. And on those rare moments when a successful back check happens in a game, Pecknold spotlights the moment. "The next day I get it on video and I set it all up," he says. "I'm not one to drop F-bombs a lot with the team. You gotta be really careful where you do that. But I do it here. I cue up the tape of the back check and set it up like it's a movie. I'll say, 'Watch Shuddy, forward Tommy Shutt, right here. Look at fucking Shuddy go. Look at him take this guy out.' And everybody goes nuts. Even if Shuddy's back check leads to a goal, I never talk about the guy who scored the goal or the guy who had the assist. They don't even exist. All I talk about is Shuddy and this great back check and how it happened because we were 40 for 40. You can see all the guys feeling it. And the next time we practice, everybody is on it, doing it, loving it." Pecknold is not the only leader to build purpose around spotlighting a small, effortful behavior. At his restaurants, Danny Meyer is known for moving the salt shaker if it shifts even slightly from its spot at the table's center. Teachers at Kip Infinity in Harlem still talk about how founder Dave Levin would place each student's water bottle in millimeter-accurate arrangement with their notebooks on the first day of school. Pixar puts hundreds of hours of effort into the technical and storytelling quality of the short, standalone animated films that run before each of its features. The short